Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll begin today with our week in review and Governor Deval Patrick's proposed spending plan for his final year in office, a budget heavy on transportation and education.
That's the single best way to prepare our people for work and for life.
Also this week, state lawmakers demand answers from the Department of Children and Families.
Your department lost track of a kid. That's absolutely inexcusable.
And in the race to become the state's next governor, a new poll puts Attorney General Martha Coakley in the lead as she calls for a hike in the minimum wage.
Is there a real reason not to do it? Because one thing we know, that when we do that, that money goes right back into the economy.
And Republican Richard Tesei announces that he'll try again to unseat Congressman John Tierney.
Our country's in worse shape and in greater danger at this moment than it was just 2 years ago.
Joining us now to talk about all those stories and the rest of the week's news is Jim Sturgis. He's the executive director of the Pioneer Institute here in Boston. Hi, Jim. Good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Dante Ramos, deputy editorial page editor at the Boston Globe, joins us from the Globe. Hi, Dante. Good to have you.
Great to be back.
So let's start with Governor Patrick's budget. The Snow canceled his State of the State address this week, but he did release his budget on schedule in the middle of the week. It calls for more than $36 billion in spending, including increases for both transportation and schools. One of his major efforts, a $15 million plan to get an additional 1,700 kids from low-income families into kindergarten. He said this week it was a good investment.
If you aren't reading proficient by the third grade, you spend a tremendous amount of time catching up ever after, or for a long time, let me put it that way. And so that what we invest on the front end saves us all kinds of money in remedial services later on.
Jim, I know you've been digging through the governor's financial blueprint for the state. What have you found? What stands out that's worthy of note here?
Well, I'd say the governor is absolutely right in terms of the quote you just had, in terms of the importance of getting kids early on, especially kids who are disadvantaged, into school, because by third grade, if you aren't reading at grade level, you are in deep trouble for the rest of your career. There's a lot in there. I'd say that we could do sort of a blow-by-blow tactical review of what's up, what's down. I would note maybe we're in the final year of the governor's leadership in the state. If you take a look at the broader picture, what you see is that the state budget has grown about 2.5 times faster than taxpayer income over 8 years. The budget in 2007 was about $25.2 billion. His latest budget is about $36.4 billion. It is worth noting that that budget does not include many things that were included at the start, such as we're paying much more, about $1 billion more a year into our pension system. There are some things that have been taken off budget. So this budget is also built on one-time revenue, things that are like $175 million taken out of the rainy day fund. It is not raining right now, as the Herald said.
So it sounds like you're saying unsustainable.
I think for anybody who walks into the door next, it's a pretty tough hand of cards they've been dealt.
Dante, I want to ask you about this. Last year, the governor sprung a big proposed tax plan on the legislature during his State of the Commonwealth speech. That led to a pretty tricky set of relationships between his office and the legislature. What do you take away from this? Is he going to be facing that kind of dynamic around this budget?
As Jim noted, this is the governor's last year in office, and it basically shows. Last year, he was trying to do this fairly ambitious overhaul of the tax system and had big transportation and education plans. And certainly he has some plans along those lines this time, but there really is a dialing back of the ambition there. The other thing that I would note is that, sometimes it can be harder to budget during a weak recovery than it was during a recession. We're starting to see groups that and agencies and groups and interest groups that during the recession weren't really pressing all that hard for increases in budgets, that are now coming forward and feeling frustrated at the lack of additional funding. And at the same time, even though, as Jacob said, the spending plan has grown, a lot more of it is being taken up by things that are like pensions and retiree health care and things that feel non-discretionary. So there's a sense on Beacon Hill and a lot of people who depend on state money that there's a lot less money that's available. And it is kind of leading to this slow squeeze on state policy. Mm.
So how do you think the legislature will respond to this? Jim, I'll start with you.
I think Speaker DeLeo has already come out of the box and said that he's going to be taking a different approach, would he consider a better approach. I think one of the things that concerns state legislators, probably more than the governor, especially now, is the fact that this budget really does not put a lot of money into local aid. And mm-hmm. they feel that
That's
pressure
being
directly.
Level funded, right. Yep. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to one particular part of the budget vis-a-vis the Department of Children and Families, because Governor Patrick has also called for a $32.6 million increase to DCF's budget. And of course, that department has been under fire for its handling of the case of Jeremiah Oliver, that 5-year-old from Fitchburg who went missing late last year while his family was under DCF supervision. So this week, an oversight committee on Beacon Hill held hearings into what went wrong. And Representative David Linsky, who's chair of that committee, really sort of laid in on DCF Commissioner Olga Roach.
Can you give me and the other 6 million people of the Commonwealth the assurance that you know that every single one of those 36,000 children in your care today are present, alive, and healthy? Can you give me that assurance that there's no other Jeremiah Oliver out there today?
Yes.
So that was Olga Roche at the end of that tape saying yes, but there was also pushback, too, from other members of the Department of Children and Families. For example, Union Representative Chris Condon said at the State House on Thursday that really the caseworker for Jeremiah Oliver had actually complained repeatedly about problems.
Month after month after month have filed caseload grievances for being over caseload. They are trying to draw our attention to the fact that these caseloads rise to dangerous levels. And we offer that, again, not as an excuse and not as a suggestion that if workers messed up, that we should say, oh, well, your caseload was too high, so it's okay. It's not okay.
Well, Dante, let me start with you. This is a terrible story, but we've had discussions here on our program of, like, what's really at the core of it? Is it a system-wide, you know, DCF not being funded, caseworkers being overloaded problem, or is there sort of a culture and organizational problem as well? What's your take?
I think the caseloads, there's certainly a problem with caseloads, and if the caseloads were smaller, it would almost axiomatically be easier for individual social workers to keep track of them. There is a kind of overarching mindset issue, I think, that exists where the depth of the human suffering that some of these social workers deal with is overwhelming and the caseloads are significant, that it does seem as though, even given that the agency's ability to triage cases, to identify what the greatest risks are, the kids who are at the greatest risk seem to have been compromised almost by the, you know, enormity of the task at hand. And so when you have the commissioner saying that, she can say that they haven't lost any other kids, it doesn't really sound all that convincing, and she didn't really sound all that convinced of it herself.
Mm. Jim, what's your view here?
I think two quick points, one longer point. The call for $32.6 million, that kind of increase, an increase is absolutely necessary. I agree with the governor on that. It probably something on the order of $10 to $15 million might get you the additional 200 caseworkers that we absolutely need for the department. The second thing is I think the union leader's right on that, and that is we do need more caseworkers. If you take a look, I guess the third point is a longer point. Look, anybody who says that this is a shock has not been paying attention. Mm. If you go back beyond the Oliver case, there were signs of trouble for quite some time. There was a court case that was decided in February of last year, and the Children's Rights, the organization that brought the case, concluded that the Commonwealth's child welfare system is, quote, one of the most dangerous in the country. The judge found in the case that less than half of Massachusetts foster care children, part of DCF, receive required monthly care worker visits. The judge cited a study showing that only 13% of DCF social workers had conducted regularly monthly home visits at a federally mandated monthly rate. Mm-hmm. We've known that's been out there for a long time, so we need to get 200 people there, professionals, to support these kids. We need to do it now.
All right.
So let's move on to the race to become the next governor of the state. Still a ways off, but we had a new poll this week, WBUR did, that found Martha Coakley, the attorney general, leading the field with a 10-point lead over Republican frontrunner Charlie Baker. She spoke at the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce yesterday and called for a hike in the state's minimum wage and a focus on income inequality.
The difference between the haves and the have-nots in this country is stark, but it's among the sharpest right here in Massachusetts. We are number 4 in the U.S. when it comes to income inequality. And it's not just the gap. It's that it's getting worse. Those at the top in Massachusetts have seen their incomes grow, on average, more than 100%. Those at the bottom haven't seen any growth at all.
I want to talk a little bit about this poll, but Jim, first of all, this theme of income inequality, it's one we're hearing Democrats make around the country. Is this this is clearly something that Coakley feels is going to resonate with voters? What's your view?
I think it absolutely does resonate with voters. I think the one thing that needs to be a cautionary note out there for all the candidates, Republican or Democrat, is that the fact is that you will impact, by increasing the minimum wage, folks who are in the workforce between, say, 16 and 21, whose jobs are, let's say, it's difficult to raise those the minimum wage and not lose jobs. Mm-hmm. So we put people at risk if we do that. By the same token, I think everyone agrees that if you work really hard, you should be able to earn a wage that you can live on. So this is this sort of a tightrope that you're walking on. I think it will be a big issue on the Democratic side. I think probably on the Baker side of this, the Republican side, they're going to be talking about job creation as, you know, a point of giving people dignity.
Hmm. Yeah, Dante, I'd like to come with you on this. I mean, Jim talked about this tightrope of minimum wage, giving people the money that they need to make a living. At the same time, job growth is also something that resonates, particularly on the Republican side. How do you think this is going to play out?
Well, all of the attention, because Charlie Baker has a Republican Tea Party type challenger, but there's not a lot of expectation that he would be a big factor in it. You have a more crowded Democratic field, and at this point of the race, they are sensing, I think, with the election of people like Elizabeth Warren and Marty Walsh, that we are in a more populist moment than mm-hmm. we might have been in a few years ago. And that resonates especially with this point in the Democratic race where, you know, each of the candidates is trying to shore up their base, their place in the Democratic base in advance of the Democratic caucuses that are coming up. One of the quirks of the nominating process is that the Democratic rules, they want candidates to have a certain base within the kind of organizational structure of the party, if you want to call it that. So they're all kind of mustering the traditional Democratic interest groups. And I think Coakley's rhetoric, and you see the other candidates making some of the same noise, it both resonates with, their immediate political need, but it's also, you know, these are bread and butter Democratic issues at a very populist moment.
Yeah, and Dante, what do you see, if anything, what do you read, if anything, into this WBUR poll? I mean, I'm not particularly surprised that the sitting attorney general, you know, has a 10-point lead in a race against a Republican that hasn't really started yet. So I'm not sure if we read anything at all into that poll, but what do you see, if anything?
I wouldn't read much more than that into it. If you look at the way the candidates perform when kind of posed against each other, it does seem as though down the line their performance is almost directly proportional to their name recognition. Mm-hmm. That's something that's obviously going to change over the course of the campaign. It does speak to some of the lesser-known Democratic candidates trying to break out against Martha Coakley and Steve Grossman, both of whom are statewide office holders, that, you know, that's a non-trivial barrier to break through.
Well, the governor's race will certainly heat up as the months go by. But I have to say, the race that's got me most excited here in the midst of cold, cold January is the one between now Republican Richard Tesei, who says he's going to try again to unseat Democratic Congressman John Tierney. Now, Tesei came ever so close in 2012, but Tierney held on to his seat. And this way, this week, Richard Tesei said he's going to run again, and he unveiled his campaign in a new video.
John Tierney's constantly putting politics ahead of doing the right thing for the people of this district, whether it's the medical device tax, whether it's the flood insurance bill that recently passed that's going to cause people to lose their homes, or even Obamacare. John Tierney promised people that if they liked their plans, they could keep their doctor, they could keep their insurance. That just wasn't true.
All right, Jim, so let's start with you, because we've seen this in the Republican Party writ large, that lots of local races are trying to hang the ACA on congressional seats, for example. Do you think that Richard Tse is going to get any traction with that?
You know, Tse is a progressive Republican. He's run statewide and regional races, a viable candidate. I don't think you're going to find any skeleton in his closet at this point, right? He's got the advantage of not running this time in a race where at the top of the ticket is a very, very popular president. And, you know, the Globe endorsed Tse, so we should ask Dante about that in the last race. So I do think there's an interesting dynamic here in Massachusetts. What Tse, I think, is saying, at least what I understood, is that, look, the ACA has not performed well. It's not nearly as good as the Massachusetts law. And the Massachusetts law was much berated, hated, whatever you want to say, by the Tea Party. So he's actually taking a position that's very supportive of the Massachusetts law, which got about 97% of our population covered. So I think he will try to ride that as a Massachusetts Republican, is my guess in terms of branding.
Right. Now, Dante, Richard Tse came so close last time. It was about a point. And as Jim pointed out, it was in a presidential election year. And, of course, that was also the same year that John Tierney had lots of problems vis-a-vis his wife and her family and their financial shenanigans, for lack of a better term. Do you think Tse has a better chance this time, given that, you know, we're not looking at President Obama at the top of the Democratic ticket?
I'm a little skeptical in the sense that a lot of the power behind Tse's campaign last time was in the problems that Tierney was having and people feeling a little unsatisfied with his explanation of the scandal in which his wife was receiving some payments from a brother who was in an illegal gambling ring, and there was some question about, you know, what were these gifts or were these income, and what did John Tierney know about it. There's a certain half-life to scandals, I guess, and I'm not sure that this one is going to quite motivate the level of skepticism that it might have last time. It seems as though Tse is counting on, his critique of Obamacare, if anything, seems a little stronger this time than it was last time. So he's clearly counting on a change in the composition of the electorate. I don't know. It could work, but it seems as though if the strategy is to attract Obama moderates and Democrats who might have voted for Obama, I'm not sure that it will necessarily work.
Mm. So, Meghna and gentlemen, this leaves time for our hubbubs, those little stories that caught our eye but perhaps didn't make the front page of this week's paper. And let's start with you, Jim. What's your hubbub for us this week?
Well, this is for fans of the movie Goodfellas. They know that this week marks the arrest of Vinny Asaro, one of the gangsters involved in the Great Lufthansa heist. Heist mastermind Jimmy the Gent Burke, it should be recalled, was part of the bookie gambling scandal involving the 1978-79 Boston College basketball team. A multifaceted player, Burke was murdering members of the Lufthansa heist gang, even as he was working his magic at BC. And as Henry Hill said in Goodfellas, you know, to me, being a gangster was better than being president of the United States. And I think it's true because he was played by Robert De Niro in the movie. Yeah. And, like, presidents are always played by people like Michael Douglas, and that's really bad.
What amazes me about this story is the idea that these guys solving these crimes are just working on and on and on and on, decade after decade after
that's
decade.
Amazing.
They get their guy. How about you, Dante?
Well, my hubbub is much closer to home. It's about the ironing boards and lawn chairs that people use to reserve curbside parking spots after they've shoveled out, and sometimes for days after a storm. It's a controversial practice, obviously, because it's backed with a threat of vandalism. It took off in South Boston, but has been spreading around the city. But interestingly, this week, Universal Hub, the local website, reported on a group in the South End. It's a neighborhood group that is relaunching its effort to ban space savers, at least in the South End, figuring that if they can't get any change citywide, at least they could do it in one neighborhood. It's a judicious solution from my own point of view. It shows that some parts of town are less territorial about parking, or at least less willing to part with their ironing boards.
Because you can never have a shirt that's too crisp, don't they?
Exactly.
Magna, how about your hubbub?
Well, actually, so we've got a winter theme going here. Mine actually has to do with ice cream because I don't know if you heard, but this week, the maker of Oreos, Mondelez International, this huge multinational food corporation, sent a very, you know, starkly worded letter to J.P. Licks about the fact that they want J.P. Licks to remove the word Oreo from its Oreo cookie dough ice cream. Now, I, you know, fully support companies' rights to exercise control over their intellectual property, and maybe, you know, every time I say the word Oreo, I should also whisper trademark. but I would just invite J.P. Licks, they're looking for a new name. They're going to change their name, but maybe they should have just invited Mondelez International to try the ice cream. And
I would say to Mondelez International, chill.
Maybe that would have helped. So no more Oreo cookie dough as a name for J.P. Licks, and they actually crowdsourced a new one, so we'll see what they come up with.
All right, well, here's my hubbub. It involves a recent graduate of Boston University named Adam Engel. He was in New York on Monday for a taping of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Before the program, he told Stewart that he was looking for a job. He asked Stewart how he could get his Jewish mother off his back about getting a job. Stewart shot back, according to Engel, and laughed and shot back immediately, asking him why his mother's religion or gender had anything to do with it. But then he sort of continued. And to Engel's surprise, here's what Stewart had to say when he opened the show on Monday.
If your school is currently looking for a chemistry teacher, I want you to call us. I got a guy over here at Boston University. He seems smart. Could have shaved. He's a chemistry major. He's looking for a job teaching chemistry. And I was like, how can you not get a job teaching chemistry? I'm sure there's a huge need. So if you need a chemistry teacher, contact us, and I will finally get this kid out of his parents' house. That's what I'm going to do. Leave your name.
So according to the BU newspaper, Adam Engel still looking for a job. But that that could only have helped his chances. So best of luck, Adam Engel.
Well, Dante Ramos is deputy editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Dante, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Great to have you.
Good to be with you.
And stay with us. Up next, we talk with Canadian writer, academic, and former politician Michael Ignatieff. He's out with a memoir about his brief political career. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.